Thank you so much, David, for that presentation. My name is Johanna Wald. As David said, I work at the I work at the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute for Race and Justice, and I thank all of you for being here today and for giving us the opportunity to present to you. My presentation is also about implicit bias, but I'm going to actually, and bear with us for some of the areas of overlap with David's, but really what I'm going to do is kind of, I think what David gave us was a really broad overview of the enormous social impact of implicit bias. I'm going to sort of zoom in a bit and look at the actual process by which some of these unconscious biases sort of get lodged and embedded in our heads and our psyches, and then we hopefully look at whether there are some strategies we can develop to sort of dislodge them. So this summer we started with a clip from President Kennedy. Today I'm starting with a clip 50 years later from President Obama in July this summer, in the aftermath of the George Zimmerman verdict, when there was tremendous, as you know, uproar over that particular verdict and a strong sense of sort of unequal systems of justice in this country. Okay, so let's go. Okay, here we go. Sound. All right, I'll just let it go. I don't think you're going to really hear. The gist of that is the president talked about all of us, the need for all of us to do some soul searching. Am I ringing as much bias? And he suggested that this isn't really a government function. This is a function that we should be doing sort of in our homes, in our churches, in all kinds of institutions. The question is, you know, am I ringing as much bias out of this situation as I can? To us, this was the idea of doing soul searching and looking to see how do we actually wring out bias. In this presentation, we're really going to focus on unconscious bias. It's unclear whether the president made that distinction, but we're talking about unconscious or implicit bias. So what is implicit bias? David discussed that at length. I'm just going to briefly sort of describe it. It's the process by which the brain uses mental associations that are so well established as to operate without awareness or without intention or without control. In other words, it has been described as a habit, but I like to see it as an association between at least two ideas or two concepts that are so deeply embedded and wedded to each other that as soon as we hear about one, the other is also triggered. And it's very difficult for us to dislodge that, so they almost go together. Okay. So here's just sort of some ways in which we make these kind of automatic assumptions. So what colors are the following lines of text? Sky, blue, grass, green, dirt, brown, sunshine, yellow, stop sign, red. That's pretty easy and quick. We make those associations very quickly. So what color is number one? Okay, what color is blue? Right. What color is brown? All right, what color is red? And what color is yellow? And did it take you a little bit longer? I mean, were you kind of like you looked at it for a second and then your sort of head did a kind of wait a second and then you had to stop and think. So there was a sort of separation process going on. And here's the other ways in which just the mind makes these kind of automatic leaps and you're not even aware of it. Which line is longer? Yeah, you guys have seen this before. But anyway, if you hadn't seen it before, wouldn't you think that the first one was longer? Same with these two people. As you know now, probably you've gotten it. They're the same size. But obviously, if you look at that automatically, you think that the first one is larger. So there's been this explosion of research in the past decade about implicit bias and its relationships to our decisions and our actions. And that this research sort of offers us new opportunities to really think and to hopefully intervene to reduce the effects, which David described in kind of devastating detail, in our institutions and in our interactions. So this was evidence from hundreds of thousands of individuals. This was kind of by two of the leading researchers on implicit bias in the country, Jerry Kang and Mazarin Banaji. The magnitude of implicit bias toward members of outgroups is large. That implicit bias often conflicts with our conscious attitudes and our intentional behaviors. And that implicit bias influences our behaviors and our actions toward those who are the subject of the bias, even though we're not aware of it, even though we don't endorse it. An inconvenient truth, and this was the words of the researchers, as disturbing as this evidence is, there is too much of it to be ignored. So three things to remember about implicit bias. We all have biases. It's a way for us to process and organize information. Otherwise, we'd go crazy. I mean, we just make these automatic, you know, we see four legs, we think chair, we make these sort of automatic associations. We have to. Our unconscious biases are often in conflict with our egalitarian value system, and yet implicit biases predict and determine our actions and decisions more than our explicit values. To me, this is what this means. It means that we may be able to change the conversation about race a little bit. We may be able to stop sort of accusing one another of being racist and kind of getting people to go off in their corners and kind of dig in their heels. On the other hand, this does not kind of excuse us from the responsibility of the fact that unconscious biases affect our decisions and our actions, often in a way that's devastating for the individual and groups with whom we have these biases. So we have an opportunity to look at this in a different way, and at the same time, we have a responsibility to address these biases. Awareness test. Here we go. Oh, okay, good. It's easy to miss something when you're not looking. So of those people who haven't seen this, how many saw the moonwalking bear the first time? No. Yeah. So, I mean, it really, to me, that kind of very clearly shows when you're looking for one thing, you often miss something that's kind of right in front of your face. So here's some research. There's all kinds of biases. It's not simply racial bias. There's gender bias, there's age bias, there's height bias, there's weight bias, there's political biases. And here's just an example of height bias. In the U.S., 1 inch of height is worth almost $800 per year in salary. And in China, this bias has led to a rash of leg lengthening. The impact of skin tone. Immigrants with lighter complexions earned about 8 to 15% more than those with the darkest skin tone. I don't know how many of you remember this from the Katrina, but there was a photograph of a young black male with a bag of groceries, and he was looting almost the exact same picture of two whites, and they were finding food. And this was likely not even anything that the writers themselves were aware of. They just sort of saw the photograph of a black youth and they thought looting. They saw the two whites and they thought finding. And it's an interesting sort of distinction because Mazarin Banaji had said that today, when most overt forms of discrimination are kind of taboo, and it's not socially acceptable to voice or express any kind of discrimination, that in fact discrimination proceeds from whom we choose to help. So it's a very interesting kind of definition of discrimination. Here's another example: anger to happiness. These are the exact same kind of facial expressions. One is obviously white and one is a black man. And when they have tested this, they've shown that the vast majority of individuals will see the white faces turning to happiness before they will see the black face turning to happiness. Where that in the real world will manifest itself, we do a lot of work on looking at racial disparities in school discipline, and often that's a subjective call about attitudes, about the sort of demeanor of the individual. Oh, he had a bad attitude, he wasn't showing me proper respect. That kind of sort of sense of, you know, at what point is a face kind of a happy face and at what point is it an angry face, are the kinds of kind of subjective automatic sort of thought processes that actually affect the decisions and actions that we make. So how does implicit bias show up in healthcare? And what I'm going to do is just kind of go through a number of studies. I don't want to sort of really talk about these in depth. This is really just to sort of look at where is there the possibility that implicit bias, as both David and I have kind of explained it, may actually play a role in some of these unequal outcomes. So the first one is there. In one study, there was a measure of implicit and explicit bias of about 2,500 medical doctors, and they found that most doctors implicitly prefer whites to blacks. African American doctors did not display preference either way. Women doctors displayed less implicit bias than male doctors. And doctors implicitly associate certain diseases with African Americans, i.e. hypertension, sickle cell anemia, even when there is no genetic reason for doing so, i.e. drug abuse, HIV, obesity. So what are some of the implications of that? I just think back about that awareness test. If you think you're looking for one thing, you're trying to focus on how many balls are up in the air, you may not see something that's, you know, right in front of your eyes. So if certain diseases spring to a doctor's mind immediately when examining an African-American patient, that may well crowd out possible other diagnoses. According to one author, implicit stereotyping among healthcare providers can present two dangers. An inaccurate component of a stereotype may be used in a diagnosis, and even when there's an accurate stereotype, it may unduly influence the diagnosis and the treatment. So pain management, which Kelly's going to talk about in a great deal of detail, I will only just refer to two quick areas. One, where male physicians prescribed higher doses of hydrocortisone to white patients, but the female physicians prescribed higher doses to blacks, and this pattern was repeated for persistent kidney stone pain, and the same with persistent back pain. One thing of note here, I think, is Banaji has talked about the areas of the brain that actually get activated when we are addressing someone that we perceive to be like ourselves. That is a different part of the brain than the parts that's activated when we see someone that we think of as different. And the part of the brain that's activated when we see someone like ourselves is closer to empathy. So it's much easier for us to empathize with someone that we perceive to be like us, which, again, today prejudice proceeds from whom we choose to help. So I'm suggesting that's a possible interpretation of this. I don't know that it is for sure, but it's sort of one area that we might think about. Differential treatment. Using videos of actors, researchers found that women and blacks were less likely to be referred for cardiac catheterizations compared to white men. The increases in physicians' pro-white bias, as measured by the IAT, predicted increased likelihood of treating white patients with thrombolysis. And as pediatricians' implicit pro-white bias increased, the prescription of narcotic medication decreased for African-American patients, but not for white patients. Similarly, in doctor-patient interactions, and this is something that a colleague at the University of Massachusetts and Amherst is doing a lot of work around sort of what she considers racial anxiety, which is sometimes when you're in the presence of someone from a different race, you kind of have certain kinds of anxiety, and that affects your body movements, it affects your the way you interact with them, it affects your sort of heartbeat, it affects your comfort level. And this suggests that there may be some racial anxiety involved in some of the doctor-patient interactions between white doctors and African-American patients. So there's the future research on implicit bias, and I do want to say that the sort of knowledge about how implicit bias actually functions and operates is way beyond the interventions about doing something about it, that we are just at the very early stages of that. So we know much more about how it actually operates in our brains than we do about how to dislodge it. But I am going to talk about some of the strategies in a second, but I do want to say that it looks like that the future research, that there are some goals about determining really the degree of different implicit biases for different groups, assessing the association between implicit bias and the actual outcome of the care, and to test interventions to reduce implicit bias. This was just a quote, implicit racial bias can unintentionally affect a healthcare professional's diagnosis, treatment recommendations, expectations, verbal and nonverbal behavior, despite their intention to avoid such biases. Okay, so can we use this research to identify new interventions? So hopefully, some of this research can help us to understand how not only it may affect our decision-making, but more importantly, what we can do about that. The good news is that self-situational or broader cultural interventions can correct systematic and consensually shared implicit bias. In other words, the bias is not kind of part of our DNA. It gets in there, and we can work to try to get it out of there. Moreover, recent discoveries regarding the malleability of bias provide the basis to imagine both individual and institutional change. So I want to kind of stress that right now it's really imagining, but there has been some work that I want to talk about. So first of all, there's something called chronic egalitarians, and those are simply people who, as soon as they learn about a conscious bias, they get upset about it, they start to think about it themselves, and they actually start to monitor their own reactions and responses. It sort of happens automatically. Many of you may be a chronic egalitarian. Chances are a lot of medical and healthcare professionals are chronic egalitarians. So simply by learning about unconscious bias, and they start to kind of watch their reactions to things, and they can start to actually check themselves and stop a stereotypic response as they start to have it. So that's sort of low-hanging fruit. That's sort of number one. And the best candidates, as we said, are these chronic egalitarians. I guess I'm repeating myself here. There is great promise in a 2007 shooter bias study that indicating that police officers are actually able to completely overcome their implicit racial bias with adequate training. And similarly for judges, that they start to apply a kind of cognitive correction to their implicit biases if they're motivated to do so. So divine intervention. There's a woman named Patricia Devine. She's at the University of She's at the University of Wisconsin. She's a social psychologist. And she, to our knowledge, has developed the most extensive set of strategies that she has actually tested over a period of time to see if she could reduce implicit biases over a period of time. One thing some of the implicit bias research has shown is that you can change it, you can affect it and reduce it kind of momentarily, and then it comes back the next day. But her research actually shows there is some promise in reducing intervention over time. But how do we do so? So she says there has to be three factors in place. One, we cannot suppress our biases. We can't not talk about it. We can't pretend that we don't have them. We can't be a colorblind society. We have to acknowledge and confront our biases. So that's step number one. Hopefully we do that in a way that doesn't make us feel ashamed or guilty or bad, like bad people. But they do have to be acknowledged. So there has to be, and then second, there has to be an intention, a motivation to change. Then there has to be attention. We have to start paying attention to what's going on, to when we start having stereotypical responses. And finally, we have to have time to practice some new strategies. But it's sort of like, she calls it breaking the prejudice habit. I think of it as kind of dislodging things that are joined together. We have to sort of break that kind of connection, that lock. So what are these strategies? So she has five strategies. They may seem a little basic. I think we're really at the beginning of this kind of research, of kind of really understanding, and we don't really even know of these five, which are the most effective. She gives them out as a toolkit with the idea that each person may sort of want to use different strategies at different times. So what are they? The first one is individuation, and it's moving beyond a racial category by gathering specific information about an individual. So if you find yourself having a stereotypical response about someone that you work with, you actually sort of try to find out more about that person very specifically. What their family's like, what their home life's like, what they do, what their hobbies are. And so by just sort of gathering very specific individual information about that person, it starts to break that kind of automatic association with certain stereotypical associations. So it's kind of recognizing that race is just one facet of other people that make each person unique. Stereotype replacement. This is when you actually, you notice that you're having a sort of stereotypical response, and you stop yourself and you replace that response. So you kind of notice it, you say, oh, that's like really a stereotypical response. You take it out and you put in a non-stereotypical response. You sort of do it in real time. And so it's kind of practicing new habits. Counter-stereotypic imaging is imagining a person who really defies the stereotype. While watching a movie that portrays black people as unintelligent, you think of Dr. Martin Luther King, you think of Barack Obama, you think of Condoleezza Rice, you think of Frederick Douglass. So you actively kind of imagine a counter-stereotypic example. And this provides concrete examples that demonstrate the inaccuracy of stereotypes. My favorite is perspective taking. This is like role playing, and I personally think this is the most effective, and this is the one I'd like to test most. But this is actually where you put yourself in another person's shoes. You sit down and if you think of a person who's being stereotyped, you think about what would it feel like to walk into a room and have everybody think of you as violent, or have everybody think of you as dangerous, have everybody think of you as stupid. How does that actually feel? And that to me is maybe this is my theater background, but that to me is like a very powerful way of kind of sort of starting to really dislodge some of the stereotypes. And the fifth one is really the one I think David talked about. This, to me, is really the long-term one. It's about just increasing opportunities for contact. It's ending segregation. It's a long-term. If you live and work with all sorts of different people, you stop stereotyping them because you know them as individuals. I mean, it almost seems like a no-brainer to me. This to me, is more like a sort of long-term strategy. The others are really short-term. But again, you just kind of can actively seek out opportunities for positive interaction with a group with whom you're stereotyping.